16. I apologise for the late start, but we're trying to fit people into a room that isn't designed to take that number. We're welcoming tonight Annette Hammett and her colleagues from the NHS Trust, and also Deborah Hallett, the chair of REL, who are coming to address us. And with your permission, I shall move those items up to the top of the agenda. Do we have any apologies, please?
Got apologies from Councillor Maddie Chapman and Councillor Tony Hill.
Councillor Mark Williamson. Councillor Terry Darville, who should be on the
speak. Councillor Pat Graham and Councillor
Fairbob. Right, thank you.
Okay.
Right.
Yep.
Do we have... Do we have any public speaking?
No.
No, right. We're also welcoming tonight our MP, Sir Hugo Swire, who's come along to add a bit of meat, probably, to a couple of questions that we've got. So anyway, we'll move on now to Council meeting minutes of the 22nd of August. Can I have a proposal for acceptance of these, please?
Councillor Stott.
Councillor Stott, and seconded by Councillor Gazzard. All those in favour? Thank you. Matters arising from those minutes, if we take it a page at a time, page 90. 91, 92, 93, 94, and House. Thank you. No matters arising. Take declarations of pecuniary interest and dispensations now. On item 12, Town Clerk will make an announcement about item 12.
Do that now, just to say that I am noting on block a dispensation for the whole council in respect of item 12. Because I am aware of shareholder interest on the part of some councillors, and obviously the council itself has supported REL Limited historically. So I'm granting dispensation en bloc to the council as a whole so that you can all discuss that freely.
Are there any other interests?
Yeah, my pecuniary interest is that my employer is South West Downs Service, which is part of the NHS.
Thank you.
Jane, in item 9... because I'm employed by Excellence and Hospice Care, although I'm not clinical administrator, but they obviously have associations with clinicals.
Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, just a clarification really. I can understand that we can be involved in the debate concerning the role, but what about voting if there is a vote?
That's okay.
It's okay,
yeah,
is
that's
it?
Fine.
Moving on, urgent business. We have no items of urgent business. To resolve the press and public to be excluded from the meeting during discussion of consideration of other items on the agenda, that will only be for item 15, which is to receive the HR group meeting notes. And that's at the end of our meeting anyway. Questions under Standing Order 10, there are none. So we're item 8, to receive and consider reports and minutes of committees, working parties, other local bodies and the town clerk, town manager as appropriate. Understanding Order 6.2. Planning Committee. Thank you very much. Seconder? Thank you, Tim. Neighbourhood Plan Steering Group. That's the notes attached to the meeting held on 17th of August.
They're just for noting. Just for noting. Mm-hmm.
And Flooding and Land Drainage Working Party.
They're just for noting.
That's for noting again.
Yep.
So we come to the... Item 9, to discuss the changes proposed by the Devon Partnership Trust for the provision of out-of-hours carers in Exmouth. Could I invite our guest to address this issue, please?
Sorry, can I just clarify as well that it's Devon Doctors Limited, not the Devon Partnership Trust?
Devon Doctors Limited, right. Lynn?
I know that the answer probably is that
And I think there is a concern amongst the community nursing teams that being able to get those controlled drugs at an immediate response, not have to travel somewhere, you know, either Exeter or Honiton, to be able to get those. And I don't know how that's going to be, because they have spoken to people who said, well, fax, but of course, as you and I know, you can't fax for controlled drugs. So there is a worry that they don't want residents, with more and more being looked after in the community. They obviously are very concerned that as that increases, obviously the whole issue is going to increase of care in the community and the people at home that may need that service. Thank you.
Okay. Certainly the Exmouth is, from a demographics point of view, in East Devon, Sidmouth and above the amount of units, very similar demographics. Obviously they have a treatment centre during the evenings and weekends, and you know, their patients, and we do support the district nurses and community nurses there. We have very strong working relationships, as you know, with the palliative care service, and one of the things that we are developing is a clinical assessment service, and we are in discussions with the hospices and other palliative care organisations, and how we can develop the clinical assessment service to better support the end-of-life patients. We do have a register of palliative care patients, and we've got the biggest register in the country, I believe, in palliative care patients. I think we've got something like 18,000 patients on the register countywide. And there's a huge amount of work that the organisation and the palliative care organisations have done. And that will not cease. So far as controlled drugs are concerned, you're absolutely right. You can't fax prescriptions for controlled drugs where you can for antibiotics or something. And they have to be undertaken and signed by a GP. But again, the service will stay the same. But again, at the moment, you know, your doctor is one doctor in Exeter, and that doctor may be out on visits, so therefore the nurse would have to wait until the doctor could come back to be able to have those drugs charts signed. So that isn't going to change. The fact that the clinical assessment service will ultimately be based at Sowton, so the ease of access to East Devon from there will be very good. In fact, in some respects, actually better serving East Devon, because obviously if you're based in Exeter and having to go through all the back roads, it can be actually more difficult. So the road between Exeter and Exeter will be very quick, and that's, there will be a second car that's based there that will support the East Devon patch, and obviously coming from Homs on one side and Exeter on the other side. But we will still be working with the community nurses for that. So far as travel is concerned, again, as you say, where there is an elderly patient, as is the current system, because a patient, whether they live 10 yards away or 5 miles away, they can't get to the treatment centre, and if there's a clinical need for that patient, we see that this home visit will be undertaken in the same way as it is now. I hope that answers your question.
I think we're all concerned at weekends with the community nurses is that, you know, often during the day there is a GP more or less at Exxon Hospital at the moment. Perhaps he shouldn't be, but he is usually. but in fairness, it was no criticism of the Devon Doctors as a whole, because we do appreciate what you do. But I think it's more that it's a lot of them have to get taxes and things, because it's where the criteria is for a home visit.
Brian?
It's treatment centres that bother me to some extent. I've actually been a user of the 1-1 service a couple of months ago. I had a heart attack. And after a long sort of discussion over the telephone, they decided I had to go to a walk-in centre. Presumably, even a visiting doctor would need to do that anyway. And I said, you have to go to Tiverton, that's the only one that's open. So I had to go to Tiverton. We had a load of tests, and he said, yes, you've had a heart attack, you better go to RD&E. Now, is it that no two medical centres are open at the same time? Is that what it is?
I can't obviously explain exactly. You live in Exmouth itself, do you?
Yes.
I don't know. Obviously, the 111 services, underneath the 111 service, there's something called a directory of services. Now, that directory of services is populated by providers. So that could be the urgent care centre, as it is in Tiverton, A&E there, or it could be us for a treatment centre or whatever. So I don't know what time of the day it was, but it will also depend on what the symptoms is of someone coming. I can't explain why you were asked to go to Tiverton rather than Exeter. That does seem odd, without somebody going through that, I wouldn't know. But it would appear to me that normal would have been from somebody from Exeter, and from Exeter would be asked to go to Exeter for that. So I'm not quite sure why you were asked to go to Tiverton.
That would certainly be our expectation of the new service, but we don't have a normal one now.
So I genuinely don't know, but our expectation would have been you would have gone to Exeter, but I don't know.
Bill, please.
Thank you, Chairman. Yes, I just ask, it's for clarity, really, because I think there is some confusion within Exmouth. And I understand, and reading from a document, at the moment in Exmouth, there is a GP on duty in a vehicle from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. on weekdays, and from 8 a.m. until 11 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday. There's also a GP based at the treatment centre. As I understand it, it's decided that Exmouth will be one of the locations which will cease to be an out-of-hours treatment centre. And it says this means instead of the GP being based, there will be a doctor out in the community carrying out home visits. Now, does that doctor turn around carrying out home visits? Is this during the daytime only on those other hours up to 11 p.m, or does it cover after, firstly, into the night? And secondly, can you just confirm that the minor injuries unit at Exmouth Hospital will remain open from 8 a.m. till 10 p.m. daily?
As far as the treatment centre, the timings of the times that we are operational at Exmouth currently, you're absolutely correct, those are the times. Overnight, as per current, the Exmouth and East Devon area are covered from Exeter, and that won't change. So that happens now. You have a doctor that works from Exeter that covers Exmouth overnight. So far as the minor injuries unit at Exmouth Hospital is concerned, we are nothing to do with the minor injuries unit at Exmouth. It's a completely separately commissioned service. So I can't comment on the minor injuries unit. I've no idea what is happening there at all.
Fred, please.
Thank you, Chairman. Yes, I'd like to say thank you to Devon Doctors and previously NHS Direct, because they've helped me and my family in many different ways over the years, and to a sterling service. What I'm looking for here is a little bit of clarification. You're saying from Devon Doctors, yes? How many Devon Doctors do we have on at the moment, at this time?
Here in Exeter, we'll countrywide.
No, looking after the East Devon area.
One in Exmouth and one in Honiton, and then you'd have your two in Exeter.
So there's two that look after Exeter. One is based in Honiton, one is based in Exmouth. Mm-hmm. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but Devon Doctors is taking on the NHS 111 from South West Downs. Is that correct?
We are the lead commissioners for the integrated urgent care service, yes.
Now, I'm concerned, and a lot of my constituents are concerned, primarily, I think we've always had concerns in Exmouth. Exmouth, what we're looking at, 36,000 people strong. The ambulance service, after a designated time in the early hours, I think it's 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, resort down to one resource, which is DCA, so crew ambulance. Now, if you look at that in the round, you've then got one ambulance and one doctor on duty during the night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, a lot of people would say, is that acceptable for a population of this town? When you look into the Clinical Commissioning Group website and look at the East Devon geographical area, there's 380,000 population. So, you know, by moving to this NHS 111 Devon Doctors system, are we improving things? I would question whether we are, with the fact that we've only got two stand in the ambulance during the night, one ambulance, and if it takes a heart attack victim up to Romford, they're out of the town, and then they've got to backfill with other ambulances from other towns or other areas. So, to me, I understand the reasoning behind it all. I understand the resources, but my question is it an acceptable level of service? Because the Clinical Commission Group on their website state that they want to provide the best possible service to the populace, the customers,
mm-hmm.
And I would just ask, are we providing the best possible service to our customers, our patients?
Again, as far as the ambulance service and the service level of commission and what they provide, I can't answer that. You'd have to ask the ambulance service and the commissioners regarding that. As far as the GP cover, the number of calls overnight is incredibly small, obviously because the people that call tend to be the people that really need it. But bearing in mind, we are not an emergency service, we are an urgent care service, i.e. things that cannot wait until your GP practice is open. At the moment, the NHS 111 services, I'm sure, is not performing particularly well at the moment. We will be running the integrated urgent care service, but the 111 element of the service, we are subcontracting to a very, very experienced 111 provider. And therefore, we are confident that 111 provider will be able to deal with a lot more of the calls and signpost patients much more efficiently, thus therefore making the on-face GPs, paramedics, or whichever, or community nurses, much more able to respond to patients who actually need them in their homes, etc., and make signpost people appropriate to the right services. From our figures, and I've got my colleague here, who is the person who's very, very able with the stats, and we've been obviously running the out-of-our service throughout Devon for 20 years now, so we've got very, very good data about the number of patients that come through the service and how many people actually require face-to-face consultations, and we're confident that the cover that we are going to provide is going to be okay. Obviously, there's always going to be that. There's no service without a risk, but we think if you have a road traffic accident or something that takes up a lot of resources, we can't do that. But from our point of view, the thing about the message I think you need to know at the moment is the fact that the clinical resource in face to face is not being reduced, it's just being moved. And the 111 service will have many more clinicians working within it than it currently has. Therefore, yes, the calls are answered by non-clinicians, and yes, they're using the algorithm pathways, which I don't know how many of you have used. It's ultra-safe, to be honest. But they will have there's lots more nurses and paramedics and that working within the service to support that front end, which will mean less double handling caused by the out-of-hour service, which will free up that resource to support the face-to-face element of the service.
I can add, in my job, the ambulance service, I do hear clinicians using that pathway, and it works very well, and they do provide good service to the customer.
Absolutely.
You've answered my question. I just hope that we will continue to provide good service to the customer.
Absolutely, and certainly, obviously, that's what we're here for. Our strapline is putting patients first, and that for us, that is our ethos. And we're still the same organisation today as we will be in 3 months' time as we were in 3 years previous. What we will do is that we will have a constant review of the service. We will invite feedback from patients, health professionals, hospice, and other providers. We will also have our internal governance structure as well, patient feedback. Sarah's wanting to say something about the patients.
Also, just to say, under the new contract, one of the things that we will be putting forward is a patient participation group. I'm not sure if any of you attend those with your local GP practices, sort of a forum for service users, carers, etc. Network. We will be setting up one specifically for the out-of-hours service. To get a direct line of feedback in to ourselves and to the commissioners. So it would be
Tim?
Thank you very much, Ron. Yes, thank you very much, Deb Doctors, for coming down here. I mean, things in the NHS, both locally and nationally, and interested to have Sir Hugo here tonight and to represent a national perspective, if you like. Money is obviously tight. It appears that your organisation has entered into a commercial contract, i.e. from a political point of view, we might say you've been privatised. So for Liberal Democrats, I think that is not a great thing to happen, but we obviously look forward to working with you as the community. We have actually in the we would have welcomed people from the CCG and from other aspects of the NHS to be with us, and I hope that maybe we can all ask our town clerk to facilitate such inputs in the near future. Thank you to our town clerk for the work she's put in to coordinate tonight. I just wanted to say that we as a party have been under some criticism from the CCG primarily for misrepresenting facts on the minor injuries unit. We suggested that might be under threat of closure. I've been assured by the CCG that is not the case, and I'm very glad to hear that particular assurance. I'd also like to say that in the run-up to this debate, there were two or three councillors, and I'm not going to name names. Most councillors in this chamber want to discuss and act as advocates for their community, and that is exactly what they do, irrespective of party or whatever. And that's why we're here discussing this issue tonight. But there have been accusations against us for putting various things in leaflets, and have been suggestions, for instance, that we should not have confidence in our leader, Councillor Steve Gazzard. I'd just like to declare... I want to declare that we do support Councillor Steve Gazzard, and that is where I'll leave it, because of his skills and his abilities and his NHS experience.
Did you want to have a word?
Yes. Well, Mr. Mayor, thank you for indulging me. I know I'm limited to speaking for 3 minutes. I just wanted to say I wanted to come along today, this evening, because I started the day off actually discussing future health provision in Sidmouth, so I thought it was nice symmetry to end the day discussing it in Exmouth. And we are going, it is true, that the NHS is going through a period of transformation. It has to, and... there are going to be some changes, and there's going to be news, I think, later on this week about the community hospitals and so forth. So, as Councillor Dunbar says, advocates of the community, it is right we all take an interest in this and are cognizant always that some of the most vulnerable of our constituents get extremely easily alarmed by changes. And so I welcome what the Devon Docs have done, what the CCG are doing in terms of reassuring people and identifying the way forward. But I really do think there is a difference between being an advocate for your community and actually raising issues which turn out to be palpably untrue for political reasons. I think it is irresponsible and deeply regrettable that some comments have been made about changes in Exmouth, which simply are not borne out by fact. Now, I don't want to be political about it, because we all know what we're talking about, but if I can urge, as your Member of Parliament, a little reticence before issuing misleading brochures and documents about what is happening, please don't bear in mind what short-term gain you think it can get you. Please bear in mind the unsettling effect that will have on some of our most vulnerable in our communities.
Thank you very much.
Can I just feedback on one thing that you said? I would like to stress that Devon Doctors, yes, we are a private company, but we are not a profit-making company. We are a social enterprise organisation. We do not have
shareholders that we pay dividends to or anything like that. Any surplus that is made, which is not often within the NHS you can make a surplus, but any surplus we make at all is ploughed back into the service for patient care. We do not pay dividends or anything to any of that, I'd like to stress that. And the practices of the GP practices of Devon are part of our organisation as well.
Jerry?
Could I just ask you something? As a person who's used the NHS 111 service numerous times on behalf of my late husband, there was one question on there that when you're in the middle of being stressed out, and you're trying to keep the person in front of you alive, you do not need to be asked, what is your ethnic origin? I'm sorry, that isn't relevant to what you're trying to deal with at the moment. That's something that can wait until the ambulance people get there, and then they can either see for themselves or ask you that question. You know, and the number of times I've had to say to them, look, my husband has been seriously ill, he is ill now, I've had enough experience to know when I need the ambulance. Can you assure me the ambulance is on the way? I'm not answering any more questions. And the one thing, the one question that is totally useless at that point is, what is the ethnic origin? I'm sorry.
I understand that. And the 111 questions are mandated nationally. And I'm sorry, whether we like 111 is there and they have a mandated set of questions and ethnic origin. It's there with NHS Direct as well. It was one of the questions that they had to ask as well. I think if you read 999, because that is considered then to be a life-threatening emergency, then I don't think you get asked any of those sorts of things. But we do. 999.
It has been on occasion. Okay. And then they say, oh, all right, we just asked the next one, you know, but it's mostly the 111.
The 111, yes, because it's not it's people that are reading 111 theoretically, albeit obviously in your case, you know, obviously you didn't have a good experience, but they are people that are in need of urgent care, often emergency care. But there are, they do fast track through the questions, but they are mandated nationally. So I'm really sorry, I can't do anything about that.
Steve?
It wouldn't probably just be me, it would be anybody.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem relevant to what they're trying to do at the
time. Can I just add to that? Just add a couple of questions from you. It's just that the other problem is, though, just to back up what they're saying, is that in addition to that, they very often ask the religion. And the real reason for that is that there are great specifics if you're a Muslim or if you're a Jehovah's Witness or if they're coming up that they have to know
what they're going to do. So although it might be tedious,
actually, from a minimum data set point of view, to be able to do it, at least to back up what you're saying there, it's sometimes difficult.
Yes,
I understand. Steve? Thank you. You can't just say you're absolutely right. It's a national criteria that they work to. And that person is absolutely right because, as you said, certain ethnic groups have certain things that they were allowed to be done and not to be done. My question is on the issue of consultation. As some members have said, at times in Exmouth, during the school, it can be 45,000 plus. We have an elderly population, and some people have faith in the new world system, some of them don't. Can I just say that I was a tremendous time and we need to do more assistance along? My concern is that when somebody rings 111, to them, it is to them, so is there an emergency? Now, they may get the information back saying, because of the information that and they may not get the correct information, that urgent diagnosis was turning into emergency. And as we've heard tonight, at times we've only got one emergency here. My question is, will there be any dialogue with the ambulance service to explain, you know, the new options that we're going to be looking forward?
Right, can we have final word from Christine, please?
Just a couple of points of fact, if you wouldn't mind. I'm assuming that the changes in the surveys are part of the recommissioning of the 111 service. And you've been at great pains to tell us that the clinical hours have remained unchanged within the delivery area, which is fantastic. So I can only surmise that the change to the delivery pattern must be in some way linked to the value of the contract. And I'm not suggesting we talk cash at this point. But attached to the contract, I'm interested to understand from you, what are some of the key performance indicators? What are some of the headline things that as a local authority we ought to be keeping an eye on to ensure that the new contract is delivering as well as its predecessor? Thank you.
Keep practicing.
Thank you. Nothing might be back again. So far as the 111 element, you mean, or do you mean the out of hours element, or both?
Both if you can.
Okay.
Without going into too much.
Sure. What I will say is there are many, many, many key performance indicators, both from a 111 point of view and from an out of hours point of view. There's something, from a 111 point of view, it's from things like how quickly they answer the telephone, how long they take to deal with the calls, how long calls are kept in queues, all of those sorts of things. And that, again, is national benchmarking that happens with the service currently here and throughout the whole of the country. And those will not change. From an out-of-hours point of view, again, there are national and quality requirements for out-of-hours. And for an out-of-hours service, for an urgent face-to-face consultation that is within 2 hours at the end of the telephone consultation, or for a non-urgent up to 6 hours post that. And again, those KPIs and NQRs have not changed. On top of that, CCGs are putting in a lot of other KPIs and that we will be, I think it's fair to say, monitored very highly from going live in October. I'm trying to think of any of the new KPIs that you have. Seven, Matt, can you think of any of the new ones that will be there?
There are lots of metrics around patient experience, yeah. Engaging the patient feedback and how patients receive the service.
And obviously any numbers of complaints and incidents will be monitored and fed back into the CCG. Anything else you can think of? Yeah, staff satisfaction as well obviously comes into that as well, which is something that actually hasn't been mentioned before, staff satisfaction.
How confident do you feel that your plans are going to be able to maintain those levels of performance?
There will be challenges, you know, the health service is a challenge, with workforce and resources and community services are stretched constantly. So yes, there will be times where it is more difficult. Exmouth, as you say, does have a holiday population. Actually, statistically, we monitored this before because we thought it would be a question that we were asked about summer and winter. And actually, from a demand point of view, it's pretty static from an out-of-hours point of view because the people in the summer the visitors tend to be a bit younger people. So it's actually pretty static in Exmouth. They say we did check that before we came. So it's pretty constant here in Exmouth, so we're not anticipating any major changes in demand or anything to what we currently have. And obviously with the development of the clinical assessment service, so we will have GPs in there to support, and we've got community mental health practitioners, which mental health problems out of ours are a considerable issue, and we're working with them in partnership trust. And to enhance that service and the both healthcare with the children and adolescents and mental health service. We're also looking at developing other health professionals within the clinical assessment service, such as pharmacists, who are a hugely skilled and undervalued and underused resource that we're hoping to support the other clinicians that are working in the service as well. So there's lots and lots of plans, and the fact that you can have direct appointments booked for you and things like that will ultimately aid the process, albeit I can see at the moment that's difficult to assess at the moment.
I think the key is, if we didn't think we could provide as good a service going forward, we wouldn't have bid for this.
Yeah. And certainly if you were doing it for money, you wouldn't work.
Yeah.
if we were, you know,
Well, thank you, Annette and colleagues, for coming along tonight and giving us this opportunity to quiz you. I've no doubt there will be future questions after October. Anyway, thank you very much indeed for coming.
We are, if you ever want us back again to come and talk to you again, we would be more than welcome. We'd be more than happy to come to that point.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
The agenda, so you have, you're welcome to stay. I'm rolling is coming up next year.
Thank you very much.
Bring the roll up now, aren't you?
Yeah,
because Hugo's
yeah.
going to stay for roll
yeah.
as well, okay? No, yeah, it's fine. I've given a block dispensation.
Right, councillors, we move on. We've got a lot of business to contain tonight. Item 12, to receive an update from Deborah Hallett, Chair of REO Limited, regarding the implications for the future of the Royal College campus following news that Exeter Devon Academy plans to create a new world-class Deaf Academy on the former Royal College campus in Exmouth. Deborah.
I'll give you the facts and the sort of things that you might have seen in the headlines. You've got to, I'm hoping you'll appreciate this is extremely early days after the 1st of September when we've got release from Plymouth University. And we have our AGM, which is our annual general meeting for our shareholders tomorrow evening. So there may be some information that I prefer to wait until we have that meeting to share. Following 6 years of detailed discussion with the university and the establishment of a very formal programme structure to support the work of REL and Plymouth University together in the master planning and development and advertising that site for sale, in July of 2015, REL was offered an option to acquire the freehold of the Owen building, along with a refurbishment grant of £100,000. In February of this year, REL submitted a bid to acquire either the whole site or areas adjacent to the Owen building. The university, in spite of resource demands placed upon REL and assurances provided to us and others, failed to finalise the option agreement and has never responded to our bid, which was submitted under an open tendering process. Up to and including the evening of August the 31st, this year, the university, in its communications with us, gave absolutely no indication of their indication to sell the whole, their intention to sell this whole site to a third party. The first we heard about it was at just after 8:30 on the morning of September the 1st, when the chair of Plymouth University contacted directors by phone to advise the following. Contracts for the whole site had been exchanged on August 31st and with the Deaf Academy, and completion was fixed for December. This included the Owen building, which, as far as the public were concerned and for the tendering process, was not actually included in the sale. The BBC, looking for a comment about the news, contacted us within the hour. They had a written press release about this, and the Deaf Academy were briefing their staff. Only much later that evening did we receive an email confirming this information and that the license to occupy would not be extended. Clearly no written note of any kind briefing REL on the situation had been intended to be sent across to us. On the previous day, on the Wednesday, we had a full morning with BBC Spotlight, who were doing a complete review and update of the programme that they'd done in February when we launched our Ways for Space campaign. So they could demonstrate just how much had been achieved in that building and on the site once we had the license to occupy, which was part of the process of giving us the option. Clearly REL would never have, the license was not meant to be a standalone activity. Our efforts in getting that building open were linked to its retention through through the option and post the sale. And the license and option agreement was meant to be to cover the process of planning and to give us security of tenure through planning and through the selling sales process. If you do have the opportunity to go up to the Owen Building and you look at the art exhibition and the work hub, I expect that you will be astounded by what has been achieved there. So I encourage you to do that. We are open. Ariel had no prior knowledge of the university's plans, and so this was, of course, very vexing. It was also, I know, a surprise to the town and district councils, and our immediate priority was to inform shareholders and to establish a relationship with the Deaf Academy. We turned that around within 31 hours, and we are a volunteer community. I do not know of a single professional or commercial organisation that would have treated a partner of 6 years standing in that way. You simply do not expose the leadership of an organisation with shareholders to having absolutely no information to hand at the point where the BBC are able to ring you up and ask you to do an interview about it. Don't imagine for one moment that you need to put words into my head about what we thought about that. We are, of course, considering with our solicitors how to address the very many unanswered questions regarding the university's decisions. I'll say no more about that at the moment, if you don't mind. On Wednesday, the 14th of September, some rather better news, we met with the CEO of the Deaf Academy. It was an excellent meeting, it was a very positive process. And the Deaf Academy will not be occupying the site for at least 18 months to 2 years. This allows them to go through the process of having the construction plans and the design and planning application done for this site. The Deaf Academy is selling the site that they were occupying in Topsham Road. They did have full planning permission for another site that they had acquired in Exeter. Both of those sites can now be sold and they will relocate their full operation and residential accommodation to Roll. One of the things that attracted them about the Roll site is that because they can utilise the Owen Building and some of the adjacent buildings attached to it for part of the facilities they were planning to build, it lowers the overall cost of their development and allows them to still, therefore, build the very elaborate and very 21st century classroom spaces and specialist facilities that they need. They do have the most fabulous design for the academy, so there's no question that this is in terms of what they're planning to do, it's an excellent proposition as an incoming investor to the town. The 18 months to 2 year time frame is of course an optimistic time frame for their planning application and construction plans to be completed. So the Deaf Academy think that to have a retained meanwhile use of the Owen Building and the area around it that we currently occupy would be a very good thing, and we're hoping to confirm that very shortly, so that the work that has been done to date and the return on our shareholders' investment in terms of getting the work hub demonstrated, getting those facilities back open for the community and being able to see what you see if you go up there now, we will be able to build on that. And the Exmouth Regeneration Board were very strong advocates when we met last Thursday about getting that, to keeping that going, and they will support us in our application to Plymouth University. Just to get this sort of clear, the completion on the sale is due in December. We need Plymouth University to agree to extend our licence, which currently runs out at the end of September, up to that completion date in December, and then when the Deaf Academy have ownership after completion, they would extend a licence to us up to the point where they needed the facilities that were in for construction. Clearly, anything that the council can do and our MP can do and anyone else who feels like it to put in some advocacy to the university, so that when our request goes in, they treat it with respect and recognise that there is some certainly moral liability on them, that all of the resources invested in it to date, including the small amount of maintenance grants they provide us, does actually get used. If that building was shut down again now, it would be a complete farce and a tragedy. The imperative that we have now is that, having saved the site from residential development as envisaged by Plymouth University, we've secured a position from which we can, along with the Town Council and the District Council, negotiate with the Deaf Academy to gain the optimum community, business and education benefits for the town and surrounding area, whilst ensuring that the Deaf Academy thrives in its new location. Their plans only require about 4 acres, and the site is 7.1 acres. So all of the input that's gone in through the planning process about the rest of the, about how that site is utilised as a mixed-use development still stands, and we need to be sure to maintain our commitment to the role that that site has in the town for its regeneration. We welcome and need the ongoing commitment of the Town Council to assist us in meeting these objectives, which we believe to be shared by the wider town and district community. And I'm happy to take any questions, and please forgive me if there are some that I feel that I need to just push back until we've finalised getting occupancy from the university.
Okay. Any councillors have any questions? Yes. Bill, thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. Deborah, thank you for that. I do understand and appreciate until November AGM. Can't divulge everything. I think it's known by everyone, certainly sitting on this table, that Exeter Town Council has always been supportive of Royal College and particularly Royal Exeter Limited, and indeed to the tune of putting £30,000 in, which has been used to try and refurbish and bring Owen Building up to what is now a usable state. It was suggested, I understand, at the Regeneration Board meeting, which I'm not a member of, that there should be a motion from this excellent Town Council. But there are probably several questions people may want to ask. The first one I'd like to ask is, you've been quite clear that really it depends whether Plymouth will give you an licence extension from the end of September up until December when Deaf Academy take over. The fact in the last 6 or 7 years they've never given you a straight answer or played fair, frankly. I wonder if they say no, we're going to come in and lock Owen Building up, we own it, and that's that. Firstly, I'd like your views on that. Secondly, negotiations or talks you've had with Deaf Academy, do you think it is likely that they would like you as REL to have the Owen Building used for community use for the next 18 months to 2 years while they sort themselves out. So two questions there. There may be others from other councillors, but then we can put the motion forward.
The question about the continued occupancy up until Plymouth complete will be put to the Vice-Chancellor and the Chair. They are executives. And if they're not able to see it in the light of, shall we say, respect for a community that they have required to invest so significantly, then I think that would be a very sad pass on their reputation. Moreover, if they're prepared to do that for the police dogs and firearm training, which they have been in active discussion about, then I'm not sure quite why we would be expected to treat the building with any less respect than the dog team. So I would be so disappointed in their leadership that I think that questions would need to have to be answered. As for the Deaf Academy, everything about that organisation is about ensuring that their children and students have full access and are integrated to the community. It is in their interests, and they've made that clear to us, to have organisations like REL to work with. So we don't have any cause at the moment to think that they don't have the appetite to do that, and I'm expecting to be able to confirm that within a day or two, and we'll issue a press release, which of course you'll get as soon as we've got that confirmed. The exact details of it, they can't obviously give us a licence till they've got the completion, but they have a common vested interest in making it succeed because they're coming here. So.
Brian, please.
Yes, I suppose all of us were all struck by the duplicity of Plymouth University. I mean, we owe you an enormous set of thanks and all those people, some of us included here, that have invested shares in it, that have kept the place alive, that have prevented it from becoming what could have been another dream. So we have to thank you for having saved the building. If it hadn't been for your enthusiasm, that would have gone years ago. I just wonder what you might be offered by the Deaf Academy. There is already planning permission for some development on that site already, so that proposed acreage is starting to shrink already. I would imagine the Deaf Academy, being obviously having a business mind as well, might think some of that site could be developed and they could develop on it, which would defray some of the costs of purchasing the building in the first place. Another question is, if you can get use of it for a couple of years, is it worth really spending any money on it at all? Because what you might do to it may not suit their needs and it might be completely useless. I think, is there a case for going to Plymouth University and getting compensation for all the money that we've already spent on it? Because that could be to no avail whatsoever. I, being a shareholder, I'm not bothered. We bought shares, we've saved the building, job done as far as I'm concerned. But there's an awful amount of money and effort gone into it, and I hope to be a bit corny, Plymouth doesn't turn a deaf ear to you.
Cherry?
Why not use the there's no guarantee you're going to be able to continue after the end of September. Why not investigate? If you're prepared to raise the money to buy the building, there are other empty buildings in Exmouth. Why not look at it with the point of view, we're going to do something with the investment we've made. You've now got people in there that, for the most part, can work from anywhere, providing you've got the IT facility and it's wired up correctly, they would probably all move with you. So you would be effectively moving your business from one place to another, from a place that there's no guarantee you're even going to get it longer than the end of September. I'm not trying to look on the downside. Past performance makes you look on the downside. Not from yourselves, but from Plymouth University. But why not start work behind the scenes and say, right, okay, we've got to go at the end of September. No, if not, we've got 18 months, possibly, to find ourselves somewhere else. But why not start the process now?
There were two and one question, actually. There is no planning permission on that site at the moment. The university put in a planning application which has been withdrawn. So there is no, at the moment, the Deaf Academy's plans are to use the whole site, but I'm quite right. I mean, there's no reason why they wouldn't look at it, as anyone would, and say, well, what can we leverage that will release capital for the rest of our building? But then that comes down to whether or not Exmouth needs it to be used in that way, and that's a planning matter. The case of compensation from Plymouth University, I referred to the fact that we talked to our solicitors about how they have behaved on a number of matters and the best way to go back to them for that discussion, so I'll park that if I may for now. What you have going on in the Owen building at the moment is not only IT businesses, I think, to be clear about this. The largest part of the space is, of course, the performance theatre. Currently cannot use the performance theatre for what it was designed for because the maintenance grant, the maintenance funding that we've had from the university wouldn't allow us to repair the floor. It can only be used as rehearsal space. We've taken over two of the seminar rooms and run a pilot to demonstrate that there is the appetite for a work hub within Exmouth. There was always an argument, a sort of background argument against everything that Ariel was trying to achieve, that there were no businesses in Exmouth. They all wanted to be in Exeter, and there was no appetite for any kind of high-tech, sophisticated, if you want a better word, industry within Exmouth. And that became completely apparent to the Regeneration Board on Thursday, that not only was there an appetite from a significant number of firms, there was also the appetite from investors in those firms. The Regeneration Board has established a working committee to work with REL in the development of that site. And one of the things that was stated in that process is that we will look to secure appropriate space, either at Role or elsewhere, for that part of REL's objectives. The other two parts of REL's objectives, of course, were for vocational education and for the community facilities to be retained for community use. There was currently nothing in the Deaf Academy's plans that will address vocational education activities for the vast majority of children, young people, adults, through their working career. So that need within Exmouth has not been met by the Deaf Academy's acquisition of the site. So we, REL and the Town Council and so forth, and the community still need to work on how that is going to be addressed. And then in practice, you would expect that the Deaf Academy would want those facilities to be accessible by the community, and that they work with community partners who can help fund them and help support them so that their occupancy is not solely on the hands of the Deaf Academy, which I think addresses the direction that you were suggesting. So we are seeking to do that.
Okay. Hugo, please.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor, for giving me this opportunity just to really repeat what I said to the local paper when the news broke. I thought it was a win-win situation for those of us who bear the scars of the lengthy negotiations over the years. Remember what Professor Lewinsky said about mitigating the loss to the town. And all I would say is, in the intervening period, I think we've come extremely close to losing that site for residential development. And the winners in this are the local community, because they won what they intended to do, which is to keep the site. Deborah, Roy and others and I had very torturous discussions over the last few years with Plymouth University, but I genuinely think that to have the Deaf Academy here in Exmouth is something which should make us enormously proud. I think it will provide employment. I think they will need to be integrated, which raises all kinds of other opportunities. Like any school, they have term times and holiday times, which means some of their facilities will be available for large parts of the year. But I am happy, as long as Deborah's, I don't have to sit through another meeting with REL and Plymouth University. I am happy to wade in as best I can with the respective authorities at Plymouth to ask them to grant you that extension. I don't think anything should be done which could in any way threaten or jeopardise the deal with the Deaf Academy, but it seems to me that if that deal is progressing the way we think it is, and if the Deaf Academy have indicated to you that they wish to allow REL to continue after a few months, that it would be pretty churlish, unless there's some legal reason of which I'm not aware, for Plymouth to deny REL that opportunity. So I think Deborah, Roy before all the shareholders, the entire Exmouth community have done a wonderful thing for saving that site for the community, and I think we should look at this as a win-win for those deaf children and their relations who will come here and the community into which they will integrate.
Thank you. Steve, please. Steve Gallagher.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I mean, like every manager, we owe you a great debt for trying to, and you're still doing your best, but what was the original idea of setting up your organisation? We all know that you've had a horrendous fight with Plymouth University, and I suppose they haven't been the easiest people to negotiate. So I'm taking from what
Lynn, please.
Thank you. My only concern is that deaf school, the Deaf Academy, because of the very nature of the children have extremely special needs, some of them are very complex special needs, which is the very reason why at Exeter there is not a lot of community use with the buildings that they have in Exeter, because of the very nature of the children that they have and the fact that it's residential. So going forward, I mean, after the 18 months, I mean, do you see that you have a separate building on that site, or because certainly it doesn't integrate in Exeter because of the difficulty and the vulnerability of those particular children?
The designs that the Deaf Academy have had drawn up, both as a concept and specifically for the site that they'd acquired in Exeter, have been done in such a way to make it viable for there to be more integration between the community and their students. Clearly, they've got to have some areas that are kept under special safeguarding conditions, but a lot of it they don't. And certainly the Owen end of the site they envisage as being much more kind of open than not. So I think that's what they're hoping to achieve, so no reason to disbelieve them.
Fred, please.
Thank you, Chairman. If we go back, I mean, Plymouth University, I mean, the history of doing things as they see fit. I mean, my wife was a victim of that when she was a lecturer at Plymouth University, and then all of a sudden they said, we're closing it and moving to Plymouth, so that's where you're going to go and work, and you know, that's what people have to do or finish. So we shouldn't be surprised about the way Plymouth University operate, but you know, they are a large educational establishment within the UK, and you know, they've got to do the best for their organisation, and so be it. But in the early days of when the college was closed, you know, we were always pressing for an educational establishment to be tenants on that site, and as others have said, as Hugo has mentioned, you know, we should welcome the Exmouth Deaf School to come into that site and set up their deaf academy. But we should also look at the work that REL has done as an organisation, and I think some outstanding work has been done. And I think there's an opportunity if, as you say, the Deaf School can use part of the site and still release the Owen building end of the site for community use, I think that should be welcomed. But have you factored in, if they do not allow you to do that, what would happen then?
Today's date is the 19th. So between the 1st and the 19th, most of our attention has been making sure that we've got the situation we're in clear. Yeah. There is, of course, no guarantee that the Deaf Academy will be able to deliver their plans. So to some extent, the situation that Exmouth is in hasn't changed, it's just the people that we have to work with. Yeah. The plans of REL are to respond, using the REL, the role site, to the Town Council and community's needs for education and community space. Yeah. So in the event that the Deaf Academy cannot accommodate on the site through the planning process how those needs get met, then collectively we will have to have another plan. But it won't be REL on its own creating that plan. That has to come in part from the group sitting around here in the District Council.
Bill, please.
Chairman, I was going to come back with that. I've heard what you said, but surely the REL was set up to try and secure part of that college for the future investment. Why does that suddenly then fall, if you're not successful, on the Town and District Council to carry that forward?
If they get the planning, if the Deaf Academy doesn't feel the need to accommodate any other partners on that site, and if it does accommodate partners, they don't happen to be REL, because it might have some other thing it wants to do. Yeah. And it gets planning permission to develop the whole site out, there wouldn't be anything we could do, short of parking a tank on its lawn. yeah, I mean, I'm not being facetious, but if the site gets developed out, there will come a natural endpoint. So we either achieve some level of partnership with them to do something, or it makes sense for us to try and achieve those objectives elsewhere, in which case we'll need the cooperation of the town, district council and others to achieve.
So effectively, REL would cease if the deaf school take over the whole of that site?
Not necessarily. It might be that there is an appetite at district council level, at town council level, amongst our shareholders, for us to use the effort, the work that we have done, and apply it to other sites in the town. Yeah. But at the moment, we're there to work with the Roll site.
Right, thank you. Bill, please.
Yes, I think I would like to propose a motion from this town council, and read out. Exmouth Town Council welcomes the Exeter Deaf Academy and supports its coming to the former Royal College site. The Council continues its support, however, of Royal Exmouth Limited and wishes to be part of any stakeholder discussions with all parties concerned, whether it's District Council, County Council, Deaf Academy, as a in a supportive and discussional role. So I'd like to propose that we can put that forward to the stakeholders.
Thank you. Do we have a seconder, please? Steve Gazzard, second. All those in favour? Those against? Those abstaining? One. Thank you very much. The motion's carried. Thank you very much, Deborah. You may leave if you wish. I'm sure you've got other things to do. Returning to the agenda, councillors, item 10, to ratify the appointment of South and West Internal Audit as the internal auditors for 2016-2017. Town Clerk, please.
We are seeking support this evening to reappoint South and West Internal Audit as the internal auditors for Exmouth Town Council for the current financial year, please. You'll recall that in the last financial year, we appointed South and West Internal Audit, and then due to illness, we had to appoint a temporary internal auditor that came from a different organisation. We've clarified that South and West Internal Audit have strengthened their numbers and are in a position and have a better fallback position should they encounter illness again, because they left us in a difficult position. And Julie and I are confident that they are in a position to support us, and we'd like you to ratify the appointment of them for the current financial year, please.
Proposal, Fred, second.
Yes.
Bill.
Thank you.
All those in favour, please.
Thank you.
Those against? Carried. Thank you. Item 11, to ratify an application to Parishes Together for funding to support the enhancement of year-round tourism promotion to support economic growth in Honiton and Exmouth. This is making a joint application with another another council for the funding. Town Clerk.
So I think people might be aware that Honiton have recently faced similar issues with their tourist information provision that we faced a few years ago. So there's quite a lot of synergy and an opportunity for us to collaborate. Honiton Town Council need to draw down some funding to pay for physical space, to pay for a website, to pay for staffing, to pay for social media. And there are gaps in what we're providing as well that we could potentially fill if we were able to draw down some funding. So the Parishes Together Fund, there's a total of £37,000 available for us to draw down between the two towns. And Chetner, the clerk at Honiton Town Council, and myself, we've been working up a proposal to put into Parishes Together. And we're seeking, Chetner's seeking approval through Honiton Town Council, and I'm seeking approval through this meeting to progress that application. The question is whether you're happy for me to put in an application based on drawing down our full quota of funding, or whether there are any other projects that you feel would benefit from Parishes Together. And the only caveat I would mention is that we're not certain that the Parishes Together funding will be extended beyond this year. This could be the last year that we're able to draw down funding. But there's certainly there's a lot of scope for us to apply this funding to tourism-related activities. Lots of scope.
Lynn, please.
Thank you, Chair. Just to say, I'm fully supporting this suggestion that's been put forward, and that we often hear, since we've lost the tourism information for various reasons, it's been difficult to be able to secure the right premises, it's been difficult to secure the right staff and the right actual promotional material that we need to be able to promote the towns we want to. We know ever since the changes on the East Devon some years ago that's become more and more difficult to do. So therefore I would be happy to propose that we give delegated authority to the town clerk to negotiate this particular item and to use the Parishes Together for what I believe is a very excellent cause. But obviously give the town clerk the delegated authority to negotiate with Honiton for that proposal, because obviously there needs some things by what the town clerk's saying that needs to be ironed out between the two and what they actually put in. And I'd hate to see this to go on for months and months and months while it has to keep coming back to town council. So I'd be happy to propose on that basis, Chair.
Thank you. Can I just add, I mean, one of the challenges we're facing with Parishes Together is that because of the disparity in our funding pot and other local parishes' pot, actually finding a project on which you can collaborate is quite challenging. We managed to do it with the Christmas lights, again with Honiton Town Council, and there is an appetite to work together on this, and I personally think it's a good opportunity.
I'm happy to second Councillor Alson's proposal that Town Clerk has delegated authority.
Thank you very much. Pauline, please.
Just a question, really. Honiton have a really nice tourist information office in the car park. Is it not there anymore?
No. Honiton tourist information has effectively gone bankrupt. And the building is not owned by the town council. It's leased, and they don't have the funding to continue to pay the rent. So Honiton Town Council, I think, are having to support them financially, in much the way that we had to take over our tourist information in Exmouth. They're facing similar challenges in Honiton. Yeah.
Steve, please. Right, thank you. Brian?
I take it it's got to be a joint project between the two towns. We can't split it at all in any way.
No.
So it means we're going to have to have discussions with Honiton over what we would do with the money when we get it.
So what happened with the Christmas lights application is that we put in a joint application for the £37,000, which is the amount that's allocated jointly to us. And then we had an agreement that Honiton would draw down their portion, which was about £10,000, for Christmas lights in Honiton, and that I would draw down £27,000 for Christmas lights in Exmouth. And I would envisage that it would work in a similar way. Unless there are aspects of the proposal where we're looking to employ someone on a joint basis, in which case we share the funding, we would be able to allocate funding proportionately as long as we can show that there's genuine collaboration in the project.
I was just hoping that having done a little tour along the Jurassic Coast that we could do more about promoting the Jurassic Coast in this town. And that would got the needle, and other towns have got much more interesting things. Honiton being somewhat removed from the coast would maybe be very interesting.
No, I think one of the aspirations we did have was to look at, food trails or vineyard trails or things that actually promoted East Devon as a whole, not just Exmouth or Honiton's towns, but to create some sort of links between them, and that's something that we can work on going forward with the funding.
Fred.
Thank you, Chairman. It struck me that
strikes me that Exmouth has obviously suffered in the past with the tourist information centre, and without going into detail, because I don't know all the detail, but Exmouth as a town has suffered with their service, if you like. And now we hear that Homerton have gone to a similar fate. Mm. I understand that Sidmouth have got a very good business model where their tourist information centre is run by the town council at Sidmouth. Could Exmouth and Honiton not have a round the table chat with Sidmouth and find out how they do it?
We have,
because if they're successful, why cannot Exmouth and Honiton?
We have had those chats, yeah. When we were originally looking at taking over the tourist information and looking at different models, we met with Sidmouth and we met with numerous other tourist information offices, and they all operate in very different ways. The models are all very different. There's different degrees of funding being put in by local authorities, different degrees of self-funding. In some cases, you know, there are full-time paid employees being paid and funded through some means or other to promote the more commercial aspects of the service, such as ticket sales and things like that. So we've had those discussions. There isn't one size fits all. A lot of tourist informations are struggling. I mean, Ron's is at the forefront of this because she's in touch with all the tourist information offices in the district. And there are two only recently that have also closed down because their models are unsustainable. The situation around Sidmouth is more complex than it seems at face value, and we have met with them.
Okay, I mean, it was just a point that I knew that Sidmouth was right. What else concerns me is that, you know, this parish is together, fund is possibly there for other things. And once again, if we're drawing money from a source that could be used for other things, we're using it on tourism, and tourism is a good thing, but once again, should the public be paying for things that the businesses should be perhaps paying for?
So the Parishes Together money has come out of the, I think it's the Housing Review Board funding, isn't it? It's to do with housing.
No, it's to do with planning.
Mitigation.
It's not to do with the
Housing Review Board.
It's not the Review Board. Just
it's definitely money that comes from housing.
Is it new build?
But £1, £1.10p per elector gets put in, and I understand it's £1 from Devon County Council and 10p from the District Council. But the criteria are that you have to find a project on which you can collaborate with an adjoining town and parish council. So if there isn't a project on which you can collaborate, money doesn't get spent. And lots of parishes are struggling because they can't find a compatible project to work with. So I think, you know, yes, we can come up with all sorts of schemes that we think we could spend that money on, but unless there's an adjoining parish or town council that's happy to work with us on a collaborative project, we can't access that funding. And that money will just go to waste. We won't be able to draw it down for any purpose in Exmouth whatsoever. So the fact that we've got a project and we've got a willing partner to collaborate with, I don't think we should turn it down. I don't think we should walk away from it, because that £27,000 will sit in a pot, and then at the end of the project it'll get written off and we won't have had the benefit of it.
I'm not saying we should walk away from it. I'm just saying the devil's in the detail. Mm. We don't know in detail.
No. Well, I mean, I'm happy to bring a proposal back, or if you want a TAF, you know, to set up. I've successfully applied to the Parishes Together Fund for the solar lighting under delegated authority, and I successfully applied to Parishes Together for the Christmas lighting under delegated authority. And I think, you know, Chetna and I have got ideas on how we can make this work as a collaborative project. So if councillors are in agreement in principle that we can use that money for tourism, and then we can work up a proposal and it can be shared with councillors.
I've got two more people who want to speak, and then we're going to have a vote on this. We've still got other business to attend to. Christine, please.
Yeah, very briefly. You've answered one of the questions in that we're thinking of applying for the full 37, which is one question. The second one was around, is the split around between Honiton and Exmouth by numbers of electors or by footfall?
So the funding that's allocated is on number of electors. It's £1.10p per elector. So our combined pot is £37,000. Well, the nature of the project is that we have to collaborate. So, again, the devil is in the detail, because we have to demonstrate to the Parishes Together board that it is a true collaboration. Now, with the Christmas lights, that collaboration took the form of us saying that, you know, there will be some lighting that we can share. We're using the same lighting company. You know, there are aspects that we're sharing. We're buying our trees from the same sources, etc., etc. But we do have to demonstrate that there's genuine collaboration.
My last question was, when does the money have to be spent by?
So normally they give us 12 months from the date of allocation, but we have had that extended. In some cases, we've had that extended for up to 2 years. Where we haven't been able to spend the funding in a given period of time.
Get one summer or two summers out of it.
Well,
bring it.
Yeah, yeah. I think the key as well, though, is that the deadline is February for this current year. So we've only got, you know, 4 or 5 months left, actually, in which to draw that money down to apply for something. And there is no guarantee. I'm hearing tales that it might not be extended next year.
Right, final one, Tim, please.
Yeah, all I wanted to say, Chair, was a proposed delegated authority to Lisa, because proposals have been made, seconders have been made, etc., etc., and I think Lisa should come back at some point and report to us.
Okay.
We've had a proposal and a seconder. Could we have a show of hands, please? Those in favour? Those against? Carried. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Item 13, to adopt a revised standing orders and financial regulations further to legislative changes relating to public contract and other regulations. NALC is recommending that councils in England and Wales adopt undated standing order and financial regulations as per its model, standing orders and financial regulations attached. We've got a copy of that here with our papers. Lynn?
Can I just say that Councillor Mark Williamson has done a lot of work on this, and obviously I've collaborated on the majority of that. There's quite a few issues that he wanted to bring forward, and obviously he was expecting to be here tonight until for personal reasons he couldn't come. Mm. Having talked to Mark, I mean, what he suggested is we either have a one meeting task and finish all party to discuss this, so that we can come to council with one document with some actual bullet points, because there's four or five things that in the standing orders that I think both Mark and I thought that probably just needed slight changes to for this particular council.
Fine.
But considering it's 5 to 9 now, which so rather than go through it, I don't know whether the opposition might be happy to have a one meeting tab. Or at least
send some information over to Councillor Gassard rather than we discuss it right now. Thank you, Chair. Oh, thank you, Chair. Yeah, people are going to propose acceptance by understanding what Lynn says, and if you want to tell, you know, one meeting, you say it wouldn't happen. It's only minor alteration, it's been about timings and things. Right, it's proposed that we have a one-meeting TAF then on this issue. Those in favour? Against? Right.
Yeah. Would
anyone like to? Steve, you would? Steve, Mark, and Lynn.
Okay.
All right, everybody in favour?
Rob.
And Rob.
Okay,
fine. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. To discuss and agree revised arrangements for meeting venue and timings for full council and planning meetings following the impending move to 44 Rowe Street. I would like here to say that I really appreciate the hard work that's been put in by the town clerk and by the members of the town council in moving the whole of this operation into 44 Row Street. We're still working hard to get things up together and getting things working properly, but they've been working under extreme duress, and I think they've done an excellent job. I would like to thank them for that. Now, Town Clerk, you're going to tell me when the meetings are. No.
So, well, I think I've sent out the briefing paper for this just to explain that we thought that the meeting rooms at Holy Trinity Church were very suitable for meetings. Good space, there's a kitchen, there's a disabled lift, there's Wi-Fi access. The only problem is that the Brownies and the Beavers meet on Monday evenings and they're still in situ at 6:30 in the evening. And so therefore it was suggested that we move the start of the meetings back to 7 o'clock. If we move planning back to 7 o'clock and we keep the full council meeting tagged onto the back of planning, you'll be here at 11. So we're planning to disaggregate the planning and the full council meetings. So we'd have planning meetings on alternate Mondays starting at 7 o'clock. And then on another Monday in the month, we would have a full council meeting that would also start at 7. The implications are that those councillors that are on planning and full council will be attending 3 meetings in a month, albeit that there'll be shorter meetings. But as Lynn pointed out, actually that's not too different to when we had the Regeneration and Finance
that's
Committee
right.
meetings on a fortnightly basis. Several councillors were doing that anyway. So if you're happy to proceed on that basis, we will work with Holy Trinity Church secretaries to agree the dates, and perhaps we can work with the lead councillors just to agree the timetable for the end of the year and then start looking up the timetable for the new year, if you're agreeable.
Pauline?
And this would take effect from the next meeting.
The only thing I was going to ask is that you said they're parking there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They do have a post.
No, it will be...
Put up during, as though it's just during the
no, it will be open.
No, there would be plenty of parking in the evening.
Steve, you haven't got a car to park.
No, I've got the number, but she's just telling me. Did I hear Lisa correctly saying that it'd be for a trial period?
So, well, obviously our council committee structure is in a trial period anyway, so I would suggest that we run this concurrently until the end of the council committee structure review period, and then we can review it.
Everyone in favour?
Fred wants to speak.
Fred.
I've just got one quick question. It's about the identity. And I know that 44 Row Street, we've got big signs up saying next to the town council.
Mm-hmm.
Very big they are and very bold. And
mm-hmm.
I think everybody who walks past will see that it's us.
Mm-hmm.
But I did send an email out to everybody because East Devon District Council planning notices
mm-hmm.
are actually referring to the council offices.
Mm-hmm.
44 Row Street, and I think there may be a bit of confusion by the public, you know, as to, especially as this is being taken over by East Devon District Council, and everybody knows it's the council offices, as to the identity on those planning notices.
Okay, so Roms can take that up with the planning department at East Devon.
Just
that's fine.
Point,
yeah,
I think
that's fine. That's fine. We can
thank
take
you very
that
much.
Up with planning.
Right, thank you very much, member of the press.
We'll
now go into part two.
Do people want their pink papers back or?